Today at Reader's Corner, an interview from our archives with Holocaust survivor and presidential advisor Samuel Pisar, author of the memoir Of Blood and Hope. I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The question I often get regarding Reader's Corner is, what was my favorite or most memorable interview? Without hesitation, I say Samuel Pisar. I interviewed Mr. Pisar in 2005 when he visited Boise State as a featured speaker at the university's Frank Church Conference on Public Affairs. Samuel Pisar died last month in New York at the age of 86. He was born in Poland in 1929, and he was only 10 when the Nazis invaded. He was sent to Nazi death camps, including Auschwitz and Dachau. And through ingenuity, ruthlessness, and luck, he managed to survive and ultimately escape. Dr. Pisar tells this searing story in his 1979 memoir, Of Blood and Hope. He was one of the youngest survivors of the Holocaust, an advisor to President John F. Kennedy, a friend and admirer of Idaho Senator Frank Church, and a world-renowned international lawyer. Over the course of an hour, twice as long as the interview was scheduled to last, Dr. Pisar shared stories from his extraordinary life, including how he survived the Nazi death camps and finally managed to escape. What he had to say was riveting. I've conducted hundreds of these interviews as host of Reader's Corner, but this one was something special. And in honor of him and his incredible career, I'm pleased to share it with our listeners today. This weekend, as we mark the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II, it's particularly fitting that we air this interview with Samuel Pisar. I began by welcoming him to Reader's Corner.
Thank you.
I suppose the first question I'd like to know, since I used to work in a federal building where many aspiring citizens would come to raise their right hand and be sworn in as citizens, how it is that you had your citizenship conferred on you by an act of Congress?
Well, I arrived at Harvard as a student, having had, after my experience during the war, a number of different nationalities that were imposed on me. And I was appointed by Kennedy to his task force on foreign economic policy. I worked for the U.S. Congress, the Joint Economic Committee of the two houses, the Committee of Foreign Commerce, and it was in Congress. Having arrived from Australia, I was still British, but I had access to all kinds of secret documents and state affairs. And it was decided that perhaps the best way to correct this would be to make me a citizen fast. It could not be done by law because the Walter McCarran Immigration Act required 5 years physical presence. So the distinguished senator of Oklahoma, Mike Monroney, proposed the bill. It went through the processes in the two houses, and to my amazement, it was unanimously voted, signed by the president, by the speaker of the house, and by the vice president who presided the Senate at that time.
Very interesting.
I must say with modesty, I was not the only one for whom it had been done in history. It was done for Lafayette, Churchill, and a few others, but they had
well,
a few...
Well, that's pretty impressive.
They had a few votes against them.
I see. That's right. Let's go back to your childhood. It's beyond comprehension for me to imagine what it must be like to be robbed of your childhood and your adolescent years, and I don't know how much or how often you talk about the details. I suppose the very first question I would have is, are the memories vivid? Are the memories blurred? Or have the memories, at least some of them, been erased?
No, the memories are perfectly vivid and I think indelible. I don't live with it every moment. I don't suffer from it. I have a very happy family, a very satisfactory cultural and professional life. But this is always there, and not necessarily in a depressing way. You see, my wounds physical, psychological, have healed long ago. But there are certain wounds, I would call them the wounds of the heart, for loved ones that never heal. And one lives with them, and it is fitting that they be a permanent memory. It's a kind of a memorial in my own being, a gravestone to my family that perished.
As you remember from our earlier conversation, I represented in the Illinois State Legislature the city of Skokie, which oftentimes claimed to have more Holocaust survivors than any other town in America, and so I represented them. I attended many remembrances, and I've talked with people about this, but I don't know that I've ever had such an up-close and personal experience as I'm having at this moment. And I guess one of the questions I have is, is it possible for you to help us understand the circumstances of your being 10 years of age? What happened? How were you routed out of your home and where you were living? And what was the next step and the step after that that wound up at Auschwitz?
Well, when World War II broke out, I was hardly 10 years old. First, we were occupied by the Soviets. So I was brainwashed by Stalin, who wanted me red. Then in 1941, when the Germans attacked the Soviet Union, I guess I was mutilated by Hitler, who wanted me dead. But soon after the Nazi occupation, we were chased out of our house into a slum that became the ghetto. And that was, as you can imagine, an unpleasant experience, to say the least. But the bad was followed by the worst when the ghetto was liquidated and people were evacuated to an unknown and unimaginable destination. And it was at that moment that I was separated from my mother and my sister. My father had already been executed by the Gestapo. And I found myself irrevocably alone at the age of 13 in the pit of hell.
Did you ever see your mother and sister again?
No.
And
no one.
Did you ever learn any more about what happened to them?
Well, I know what happened.
Obviously you know what happened. I guess how or where.
They were immediately taken away and gassed in the death camps.
And so you're 13, and where do they send you at this point?
At that point, my first camp was Majdanek, by the Nazis in Poland to Majdanek. And that was probably worse than Auschwitz. No survivors. Today you can count them on the fingers of two hands. There was no way out of that place except through the chimney. Mm-hmm. And the reason I escaped was that at one point, after roll call, the commander of the camp announced that 250 tailors were needed. So I had the temerity to declare myself a tailor, a buttonhole maker. I figured it wouldn't be credible to say I was a tailor. And when he interviewed me and looked at me with derision, he said, "So you think you're a tailor?" I said, "No, sir, I'm a buttonhole maker. When you make military uniforms, the tailor produces the garment, but the buttonhole maker on a difficult machine that I know how to operate punches out the buttonhole and saws around it." Made sense to the Nazi that if you need tailors, you need buttonhole makers, and he sent me to the side of life. It was a...
To the side of the camp that meant you might stay alive
camp,
for a while.
To a slave labor camp.
Slave labor camp.
Which gave me a temporary lease mm-hmm. on life.
So you knew, walking into that first camp, that this was a death camp, and you better figure out a way...
Absolutely.
Didn't ...to talk your way out of it.
Any time at all to understand where I was.
You know, this sounds very familiar. The Italian filmmaker of a few years ago, and I can't think of his name, but he did...
Benigni.
Benigni, of course. And I believe tailoring was in that movie.
Well, he and I had a conversation. He inspired himself to some extent from my book.
I'll be darned.
And the main scene in that book at the end, in that movie at the end, when the tank with the white star arrives and is the moment of liberation.
I'll never forget
that. That is taken from my book. That is how I was liberated, by a Sherman tank with a white star.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. Today we're featuring an interview from our archives with Samuel Pisar, a Holocaust survivor, lawyer, and author of the memoir Of Blood and Hope. Mr. Pisar died last month in New York City. So you went on to the second camp, the slave labor camp, and what did you do there?
I made buttonholes.
You did? You qualified as a tailor, a buttonhole maker.
Yes. Of course, there was no gas chamber in that camp.
Mm-hmm.
But there you died of hunger, of punishment, of typhoid, and other things of that kind. And, of course, it decimated the population of that camp. But the gas chamber came for me in Auschwitz.
How long did you stay in that camp?
About a year. Auschwitz was, of course, that's the most famous,
of course,
circle of hell.
Right. Now, what happened there?
Oh, a lot.
I mean,
more
to
than
you.
I can tell you.
Oh, a lot and to you.
Yeah. But essentially, you see, it's difficult to answer that kind of question. But what I will tell you is that having realized that I was alone, and to most people, the first shock was so brutal that they gave up. You just didn't want to live anymore. I myself was tempted very often to put my hand on the electrified barbed wire and end with it. But I was driven by rage against man and God. And I made up my mind. I felt I owed it to my mother, to my family, that someone should remain alive. So I became, I think, like a young animal, reacting with instinct and intuition. You become a kind of an animal that in the jungle learns how to detect danger and to react. And perhaps maybe because there wasn't much that was going on in my brain because I was so young, I wasn't distracted by too many ideas. It was not a rational thinking process. It was sheer instinct. And it worked for me like a charm, time after time. Of course, there must have been some luck to it and maybe some divine providence, but it was an effective, instinctive process the way a small animal survives among predators in a jungle. Mm-hmm.
Did you find yourself in a position where you would actually bargain or negotiate with the Germans?
One negotiation is very specific. When I arrived at Majdanek, it was after a 72-hour journey in a cattle train from my hometown to the death camp. And when we arrived, a good part of the people in the cattle car, my cattle car, died. Not only of hunger, mostly of thirst. And when we were chased out by the SS guards with their vicious dogs, they would let in a dog into a cattle car. The dog would tear up three people, and all the others would get out there very get out of the very fast. And I only had one thought. I needed a few sips of water, or I was not going to last much longer. So in that barbed wire enclosure, I saw the Nazi guard on the other side, and I walked out to him, up to him, and I pulled out my father's gold watch, which my mother had given me thinking that maybe it would help me somehow, because she knew she was going to die. And I dangled it at him. And he says, throw it to me. And I said, no. Sir, I knew how to speak German. Can you bring me a bottle of water? He said, I told you, throw it to me. I said, no, the water first. He could have shot me, but he wouldn't have had the watch because I was on the other side of the barbed wire. So he went and came back with a bottle of water. He pushed it under the barbed wire. I pushed him the watch. And I put the bottle to my lips and started to take a few swallows. At that moment, a bunch of other prisoners jumped at me. The bottle fell, it broke. They went down on their knees to lick up the moisture from the earth. But I had had enough to at least keep going. And since you speak about negotiation, I might add a footnote. In my entire life as an international lawyer who has been involved in some of the biggest negotiations for my clients in the world, I consider that this was my most masterful negotiation, because it was a matter of life and death, and I prevailed.
Of course. How many of your contemporaries were in these various camps as you moved from one to another? Were there many 13-year-olds? Were there many 10-year-olds?
There couldn't be. There was no right to live below the age of 18. There were a few young kids, particularly twins, that were picked out and on which the Nazis performed medical experiments. Right. This was the only junior population in the camp. Between the ages of 16 or 18, even at 16, forget it. So to make the point more succinctly, in my school in this town of Bialystok in Eastern Europe, we were 500 students. At the end of the war, I was literally the only survivor.
You're listening to an interview from our archives with Samuel Pisar, one of the youngest survivors of the Holocaust and an advisor to President John F. Kennedy. He died last month at age 86. How had the others met their fate? Early in their encampment, or?
Well, when you arrived at a place like Majdanek or Auschwitz, the first thing to do was, the first thing you knew is that you were told to strip yourself naked. And then you were in a single line filing past a man who would decide, a Nazi officer, who would decide who lives and who dies immediately. So he would stand there and look at the condition of every male to see if he was strong enough to be a slave laborer. And he would send people to the left and the right, and sometimes he would take a draw on his cigarette and break the rhythm, and that made the difference whether you were going this way or that way. But you were told that you were going to take a shower, and those who went to the wrong side went into a shower room where what came out of the sockets was gas, and those who were to live a little longer got a cold shower. And that decimated the population immediately, because many more people died compared to the number of people they needed for work.
Did you actually find yourself in that situation where once you actually made the right turn as opposed to the wrong turn?
I passed by the infamous Dr. Mengele.
Oh, sure.
The angel of death.
Right.
Four times. Three times it worked like a charm. The fourth time, that was it. It's perhaps too long a story to tell. How much more time do we have?
Go right ahead.
When you know that it's the end, It's very strange. I figured that's it, so be it. All you really feel is a little bit of nausea in the stomach. I wouldn't even describe it pain. I hope it never happens to you or to anyone you know, but it's for people who don't have that kind of experience, dying is a big deal. In those circumstances, those who had gone through it have discovered that you reconcile yourself to your fate. I, because I was young and ignorant, probably wasn't willing to recognize myself, to reconcile myself as other people. So as they were leading us through the corridor in the direction of the enclosure in front of the gas chamber, waiting our turn, I saw a bucket and a brush, bucket of water. And I don't know by what logic, but I bent down, I crawled towards it. I put the brush in the water and I started to scrub the floor. You know, it's a case of don't just stand there, do something.
Right.
And I scrubbed diligently, all the time making my way backwards towards the door through which we had been marched in. And when I came closer to the guards who were standing there with the machine guns, they almost became participants in my work because one would yell at me, "You pig, look, there is a spot, you haven't cleaned it up." So I would shuffle over to that and make it gleam.
And how old were you at this point now, just to put this back in
perspective? At this point, I was coming close to 15. And I was doing it slowly. And when I came closer to the door, I worked particularly hard, probably to show, if I understood what I was doing, that I was not in a hurry, as if I was there to do a job. And then I stood up, I put the brush on my back, I picked up the bucket, and with a very deliberate steps, I walked away and lost myself in the anonymity of the camp.
Mm-hmm.
That is an extreme case, but it explains the statistic I gave you. Someone had to survive. It happened that it was me.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were 16, it's my understanding that you were saved by an American soldier who literally pulled you into a tank hatch to escape gunfire. Was that the moment when you were freed?
Yes, that was. I was still 15. It was after the Normandy landings. And I was on a death march. A couple of thousand people were being marched under machine gun carrying guards toward the camp of Dachau near Munich. And we were in the third day of the march, and suddenly three fighter planes swooped down, American. They took us for a column of the Wehrmacht, so they started to strafe us. And there was a moment of confusion. Our guards hid the dust, and several of us made a break for the forest. I was one of them. A few were shot. Some made it to the forest, including myself. We ran and ran, and then we stopped. They couldn't pursue us because they would have lost the column. And we started to make our way in the direction of the Western Front, from which we could hear in the distance, about maybe 10 or 15 miles away, the sound of artillery. And as we came closer, we decided to lie low, and we hid in a barn. And a few days later, I heard a strange sound, a kind of a metallic humming sound. I looked through the slats, and I saw a tank. I looked for the hateful swastika, but couldn't see it. And suddenly I saw this strange emblem, a five-pointed white star. So there I lost my marbles. I pierced through the thatched roof, jumped down towards this vision, and caught myself in crossfire. And suddenly the tank stopped, the turret turned. It fired two salvos, and it neutralized the Nazi machine gun fire. And I couldn't control myself, so I kept running. And there was this column of tanks, armored cars, and a GI climbed out with pistol in hand, trying to make sure the kid wasn't booby-trapped. And I fell on my knees, put my arms around his legs to signal him that I was a friend and in need. And I knew a few words of English. My mother spoke English. When she was thinking of her deliverance, she would say, "God bless America." You know, that was standard Jewish expression at that time in that part of the world. So I yelled, "God bless America," and he picked me up in his arms. I was skeletal. I had a shaved head, sunken eyes, and he led me gently through the hatch into the womb of freedom. And that was the moment of liberation.
Mm-hmm. Was he an officer? No. Was he enlisted?
No, he was private. And I later found his family. He was dead. He died, I discovered, in 1962. But at the Los Angeles Olympic Games in 1984, I was the chief counsel of the International Olympic Committee. And I was interviewed on television, and I described the story of my liberation the way I have just described it to you. I believe it was on the Dick Cavett show. And evidently, an elderly lady heard me, and she called the station, and she got through to me, and she said, her name was Valerie Crowley. She said to me, "Sir, you have just told the story that my brother Bill used to tell us often. Bill is dead, but I wonder if you are that person that he carried in his arms." You can imagine what it did to me. I immediately had her invited to the Olympics. She came in a wheelchair with her granddaughter. And
a photo, I hope?
Oh, yes, there are photos. And Mayor Bradley of Los Angeles at that time, with the Wiesenthal Center of Los Angeles,
sure,
created an event where they gave a scroll, what they called a liberator scroll, to Mrs. Crowley in favor of her brother for having saved yours truly. It was a big event in the middle of the Olympics. Very moving.
1984. What a story.
Los Angeles.
That is incredible.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Samuel Pisar. Next week, we'll continue our conversation. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. Our show is now on PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Find us by going to prx.org and search for Reader's Corner.